and this court should not regard itself as bound by its dicta previously and should hold to the contrary. If there are no further questions, thank you, Your Honor.
All right, thank you.
Case number 10-1358, consolidated cases, NSPS issues. Mr. Doniger for environmental petitioners and state intervenors, Mr. Phillips for industry petitioners, Ms. Peebles for EPA, and Mr. Phillips for industry intervenors in support of EPA.
Mr. Doniger.
Sorry, Your Honor, we had the order mixed up. My name is David Doniger for Natural Resources Defense Council and the other environmental petitioners in the intervener states on the carbon dioxide issue, and I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. The problem here is that the final action purports to complete EPA's periodic review and revision of the 111 standards, but in that action, EPA announced a decision not to establish limits on carbon dioxide. It did this having found that this is a greenhouse gas that endangers public health, that cement plants are the third largest source, industrial source, and there appear to be many applicable control technologies. This decision was contrary to law and also arbitrary and capricious.
I thought the agency said that it didn't have enough information yet to propose standards here.
The agency had articulated a two-part test. Are there large emissions? Are there best demonstrated control technologies? And it has plenty of information on which to base the decision. But even if it needed more information, it had the obligation to collect that information in order in a timely way to make a timely decision within the review period, and in this case within the consent decree period.
Well, but the question is whether it's final agency action when the agency says we are going to set standards, we just need to collect more information.
Well,
that's the question.
In the final action notice, the agency says, has a section marked final actions taken.
Yeah, I know that's what it says, final agency action, but that doesn't control our judgment about whether this is final agency action.
Well, if it is not final agency action, it's clearly a deferral of the performance of the mandatory duty to complete the review and revision. And that also is reviewable in this court under Section 307B2. It says, B2 says these are also, these kinds of deferrals are also reviewable under B1. So either it's a final action not to set a CO2 standard or a deferral of the duty to make the decision.
Yeah, but see, the problem with that argument, I understand what you're saying. What concerns me about it is that under your theory, any time an agency says, I would agree with you if they said, we've made a decision not to regulate, that would be final agency action. Or if they said, we're going to defer any action for 5 years, we're not going to act, that would probably be final agency action. But agencies often say we don't yet have enough information, and then they collect information and then finally regulate. And under your theory, it would be reviewable at the point where the agency has said we don't yet have enough information to act.
Well, the agency itself says that what it's done is defer.
But it's deferred it not into a date certain or anything. It hasn't
that's the problem,
put it off the year. It said, well, that's what we have mandamus for. The question is whether this is final agency action. And
we believe we have the agency having said under the
it says it's working towards a standard for greenhouse gases.
Right.
This is not the end of the matter.
It had a duty to complete that.
It says it's collecting information and will issue standards.
Right. Well, I point out that nothing has been done since that.
And in American Lung, which you rely on, they made a final decision not to regulate.
And in this case, they announced a final decision to not including a CO2 standard, excluding a CO2 standard. So we believe this was a final action.
You have a case that, what's your best case
American
other than
Lung.
American Lung?
I'm sorry, that's the one I would have cited.
Okay. Well, go ahead, make your point about American Lung then.
Well,
why is this like American Lung?
There's a in under Section 108, which is where American Lung, and 109, which is where American Lung was. There's the same periodic obligation to review and make appropriate revisions, and it is incumbent on the agency to make that decision to within the same time period. Now, if I may contrast this with Massachusetts, the Supreme Court's decision in Massachusetts, the Supreme Court said, and even there was no specific time frame in 202, but the Supreme Court said the agency had an obligation either to make a positive or a negative endangerment determination. There was only one other alternative, and that was to defer in the case where there was such profound uncertainty that beyond the agency's control, beyond the agency's capacity to answer, so that it couldn't come to the judgment which was required by the statute on the evidence it had. Here, this data is not profound uncertainty. This is a very shallow uncertainty. Mm-hmm. The agency says it needs certain data, which everyone would have to agree is within the, if they don't already have it, is within the possession of the companies, and all it takes is an information collection request under Section 114 to get it. There were 2 years of rulemaking procedure.
So your theory is that this is, in effect, a decision not to regulate.
I think it is a decision, but certainly in effect as well, a decision not to regulate. Mm-hmm. And the question is whether the agency can, by not performing the duty to collect information, which is certainly, if you have a duty to make a decision whether a standard is appropriate and the data you need is within your grasp to get, you have a duty to get that data within the time period allowed for the rulemaking. It would defeat the.
See, again, that sounds like mandamus to me.
But we're
not the question of whether agency action is final. I mean, we have lots of cases where agencies are mandamus because they haven't acted.
Well, I think that's what B2 jurisdiction is. When you have a deferral in a final decision of a mandatory duty, review is available in this court. That sounds a lot like mandamus. What would a party be coming to this court to ask for, namely to ask the agency to do the thing that was deferred because they haven't given good reasons for a deferral. Now, it's to the extent that lack of data is given as the reason for the deferral, my point is that this data was always in their control, always within the capacity to collect within a reasonable rulemaking period. It's not the kind of profound uncertainty that theoretically could have blocked an endangerment determination under the third prong in Massachusetts. Otherwise, an agency can defeat a review and revision obligation simply by refusing to collect the data or by refusing to issue the proposal. So in a sense, I guess it is, the analysis is the same as a mandamus action. The question is whether the agency, given all the delays involved and given the two-year consent decree, and now given the punt, we're working towards the proposal. It would be one thing if we saw some evidence that there was a proposal, but there's been nothing since no action at all, no movement, and no data collection since the decision last year. So again, the agency has two criteria. If you examine the notice, it's pretty clear that the agency believes there are large emissions from this category. It's the third largest industrial source category of CO2 emissions. And it's pretty clear the agency thinks there's a whole set of demonstrated control technologies. So these new data, missing data arguments fall in the category of excuses, it seems to us, because they had so much data already in their possession and, again, had the capacity to quickly go out and get the data they say they lacked. We have no expectation, no basis for an expectation about when this action would be taken. You could read the notice. If this notice had just come out yesterday, you might have thought, well, they're going to get to it in short order. But it's been 14 months since then, and they haven't even initiated the information collection request. We know that because there are procedures that they have to undertake to get permission from OMB to make the information collection request, and nothing, none of the steps towards that have been undertaken. That's why we are asking you to impose a deadline. So, in effect, we are here on mandamus, and a deadline that would respect the priorities the agency's articulated for other actions that it's taken. I would note we've already been to a district court because of the failure to take any action. And so that's why this fits the B2 scenario, if not directly a final action under B1. And I'd like to, if there aren't other questions, save the time for a while.
All right.
Thank you.
Phillips.
Thank you, Judge Henderson. Sadly, you're going to have to listen to me a little later, and I will respond to my colleague's comments. But for now, I'm going to focus on a slightly different complaint with respect to the new source performance standards. The fundamental problem here is the decision by EPA to simply incorporate wholesale the NESHAP standards as the appropriate standards for the new source performance standards. And so the first point I ought to make is that if you accept my argument from the first few minutes that the NESHAP standards ought to be set aside and reconsidered, then the NSPS standards obviously would be set aside as well, because you can't incorporate invalid regulations as an approach in the first instance. But even if I'm wrong about NESHAP, and the question is, can you just simply take those standards and apply them wholesale? The answer is no. And it seems to me this is almost a classic illustration of why the administrative procedure process ought to work the way it does, which is that EPA ought to propose clearly what it plans to do, get responses from all interested parties, and then act accordingly. Because what seems almost certainly to have happened in this context without psychoanalyzing the agency is that they approached the NSPS process the traditional way, which was to try to figure out where it costs and what was achievable and analyze the industry and make a determination about what standards would be appropriate under those circumstances. That was the notice of proposed rulemaking. But by the time it got to the final rule, somebody had the bright idea that, wait a second, you know, we're gonna impose these incredibly stringent standards under NESHAP. And they're going to have to comply with those anyway, so why worry about the NSPS rule? Well, that's all well and good as far as it goes, but unfortunately, it doesn't go to the question of modification. And the agency flatly just completely has ignored the problem of modification
in
this context.
Hasn't the agency agreed to reconsider the modification?
Well, yes, it says it's going to reconsider the modification, but it leaves the standards in place.
But if we agree with you that it should be stayed, then doesn't this issue go away?
Yes, if you're going to stay this, and
then this is going, right? Even if we sustain the NESHAP standard, the point, what is it, 0.01?
Right.
NESHAP standard for PM.
0.01.
And
the 0.01?
Yeah. If we sustain that and stay the modification, then this issue goes away. I realize your point, it doesn't if we set aside the NESHAP standard, but if we sustain it,
right,
and agree with you about the stay, we don't have to worry about this issue.
Well, no, I don't. I mean, that would take care of probably the bulk of our concerns, but you still end up in a situation where you're imposing as the minimum or as the requirement for NSPS a standard that doesn't take into account the legal analyses that you're supposed to under the NSPS. They've just simply substituted NESHAP for NSPS.
But even assuming you're right about that, that argument would have no impact if we sustain the NESHAP standard and stay the modification.
Well, it would, because obviously the standards set under the NSPS, right, are also the baseline for other regulatory schemes of the NSR. So if you leave this in place, it has implications for other regulatory schemes. The wiser course to follow, the more appropriate course to follow is simply to vacate and allow the agency to go back and do the job it's supposed to do, which is to set NSPS standards based on NSPS standards rather than simply ignoring all of those standards.
With respect to this case, not other cases, just this case, I understand what you'd like us to do, but wouldn't you get effectively the exact same relief by getting your stay here if we sustain the NESHAP standard?
Well, no, we wouldn't get the same relief. Right. Whether the relief would affect us as a practical matter in some respects in terms of what we do by creating new sources or reconstructing old sources that would be subject to NESHAP anyway, as a practical matter, probably wouldn't make any difference.
Right.
But we would still be subject to distinct standards that are supposed to be set by using two different methodologies.
But even if we invalidated the standard here, all the sources, all new sources except modified sources, would still be subject to the PM standard.
Right. But the truth is, Judge Tatel, if you simply set aside this rule and left everything the way it was before, we would have the NESHAP standards, if you assume, contrary to my previous argument, that's the right standard. You would have the NESHAP in place that would control new construction, would control reconstruction, and then modification would not be subject to the same rule. And therefore, we would accomplish the same thing if you set aside the rule in terms of what EPA is trying to achieve here. But we wouldn't have the collateral consequences of having a rule in place and standards in place that purport to be applying NSPS, but clearly do not apply NSPS because they were used through a fundamentally different methodological approach. So it seems to me that the fundamental point, and I don't think I need to belabor this argument particularly, is that this is a situation that's deeply flawed. In some ways, EPA recognizes that it's deeply flawed. And the solution to it, while a partial solution and a helpful one, obviously, would be to stay this. I don't think that gets the entire job done, and the court ought to vacate the rule and ask the EPA to go back and substitute the NSPS analysis that the statute clearly requires it to follow. If there are no questions, Your Honors. Thank you.
Oh, can I just ask one?
Sure.
I just want to ask you about the notice, your argument about notice and CEMS, right? You know, you argue that you had inadequate notice about that, right?
Right.
But in the NESHAP proceedings, you did comment on this, right?
Well, we commented on it because what they said was that the CEMS was a possibility.
Right.
But they never proposed it as a requirement.
Uh-huh.
And so that's the, you know, if you're going to propose it as a requirement, trust me, we're going to comment differently than if you're saying, should you do it as an option?
Uh-huh.
So that's the fundamental difference between the two.
All right. Okay, thank you. Right.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Peoples?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Again, my name is T. Monique Peoples, and I'm here today on behalf of EPA. Respondents in this matter. With me at counsel's table remains Daniel Durkee from DOJ and Steven Silverman from EPA. PCA challenges the NSPS based on the emission standards that EPA rationally included, while environmental petitioners challenge the NSPS for what EPA reasonably omitted. Both challenges, however, should be rejected because EPA based the NSPS on the evidence that was in the record and its determination was reasonable. Now, I'll go ahead and start first with EPA's PM limit for newly constructed sources. PCA assumes that because EPA set the same PM limit for both the new source NESHAP and the NSPS, that EPA must not have considered the factors mandated by Section 111. But PCA's assumptions are wrong. The record shows that EPA did consider costs in setting its PM standard. At proposal, EPA specifically determined the cost of PM controls, which are fabric filters with membrane bags, and determined that those costs were reasonable. In the final rule, EPA set a lower PM limit based on the same technology and determined that the technology would be even more cost effective under the final rule because greater emissions would be received at the same cost. Thus, EPA did not, as PCA suggests, abandon or discard its prior cost analysis. In addition, EPA concluded that the cost for PM controls could be attributed to the NESHAP, thus resulting in no additional costs under the NSPS. Now, EPA had set the same PM limit for both the new source NESHAP and the NSPS based on the same controls, and therefore, these new kilns will have to install the same PM controls to comply with the new source NESHAP. Therefore, there will be no additional cost for the NSPS. So with respect to costs, EPA reasonably determined that either the NSPS cost would be reasonable or no cost would be attributable to the NSPS at all. Non-air impacts and energy requirements were also considered by EPA as required by Section 111, and EPA found them non-existent or at most minimal. PCA offers nothing to rebut these findings. The record also shows that EPA's PM standard is achievable for newly constructed sources. Simply put, EPA did not blindly adopt the PM limit for the new source NESHAP. EPA reasonably set the PM standard in the NSPS based on demonstrated performance levels of well-operated cement kilns of varying ages and different design types. Now, altogether, EPA analyzed PM emission data from 45 different kilns. EPA identified the best performing kilns from this group. These kilns included both kilns of older design as well as newer preheater precalciner kilns, varying ages between 9 and 46 years old. From this pool, EPA determined that both newer and older design kilns were achieving PM emissions as low as 0.001 to 0.01 based on multiple averaged observations. The Lucerne Valley kiln was the best performing kiln with averaging emissions less than the promulgated standard based on multiple stack tests. Now, PCA argues that this kiln is not representative of the industry as a whole, but PCA never explains why. The Lucerne Valley kiln is a 29-year-old precalciner kiln. EPA took stack test data based on 12 different observations operating under a variety of conditions, and as required by the NSPS National Lime case, EPA applied the UPL equation to the test data from this kiln to account for numerous types of variability that are relevant here, including short-term variability, long-term variability resulting from the operation of emission control technology, as well as operating variability over a 30-day averaging period. PCA also argues that the final standard is not achievable. And again, PCA offers no explanation why. The Lucerne Valley kiln achieved the final PM limit even without using membrane bags. Thus, PM levels well below the final standard are certainly possible and are certainly expected. In addition, two other kilns from the top best performing kiln, both of these are of older design, achieved PM emissions of less than 0.01, further demonstrating the standard's achievability. EPA even referred to this very fact in the final rule, and that's at JA1148. This is therefore not a post hoc rationalization as PCA claims. I'd like to now turn to PCA's notice argument. The record shows here that PCA had notice of and commented on every issue that it now claims lack of notice. Now, as an initial matter, EPA is not required to select a final standard.
In the NSPS proceeding?
In the NSPS proceeding and also in the NESHAP proceeding.
What about the CENS?
Well, EPA specifically proposed to provide sources with an option to monitor for compliance using PM SEMS in the NSPS rulemaking. PCA commented on that fact in the NSPS rulemaking. It agreed that PM SEMS should be an option, but it disagreed that it should be a requirement. In addition, PCA commented on this in the NESHAP rulemaking as well. Also, PCA commented on...
Mr. Phillips said that there was no proposal to make it a requirement.
That's true, but EPA did provide notice that it was considering providing PM SEMS as an option. Now, the fact that it didn't say that it was thinking about making a requirement, it still gave PCA notice, or put PCA on notice, that EPA had this under consideration. and EPA did receive their comments on it. So, again, there's nothing harmless about this. EPA effectively received PCA's comments on PM SEMS in both the NSPS rulemaking and the NESHAP rulemaking. EPA also received comments from PCA on the final limit. PCA complains that EPA proposed one limit and selected another limit, but PCA's own comments suggested a different limit than the one EPA proposed. Furthermore, the final rule is a logical outgrowth here because PCA was the one who submitted the data supporting a different PM limit. Also, is with respect to the UPL statistical formula equation, PCA commented on that as well. Now, at proposal for the NSPS, EPA did not specifically suggest using the UPL. It used another statistical formula called the student t-test to account for variability. And again, both have the same purpose. The UPL and the student t-test were both used to account for variability. But again, in the NESHAP rulemaking, EPA specifically explained this formula and specifically proposed it. PCA representatives met with EPA and exchanged various email communications back and forth about the UPL equation, and EPA changed the statistical formula based explicitly on PCA's comments. Therefore, this is another instance of harmless error, if there was one at all. EPA effectively received PCA's comments and criticisms about the UPL equation. Therefore, even if PCA had commented on the UPL and NSPS, the same rule would have resulted. It was for this reason that EPA appropriately denied PCA's petition for reconsideration on this issue. PCA commented on every issue. Therefore, it didn't show that it would have commented differently or said anything in addition had it also received notice of these issues in the NSPS. I would now like to turn to PCA's arguments based on modifications, and I'll start with the PM standard for modified sources. Now, as Judge Taylor, as you noted, or as you commented, EPA has already agreed to reconsider the standard for the PM standard for modified sources. So the only argument here is whether or not EPA acted arbitrarily and capriciously by not granting a stay of that standard. EPA's decision to reconsider the PM standard does not automatically entitle PCA to a stay of that standard.
The agency's reason for saying no stay is that there's no harm here because, am I right, there's no harm because kilns can avoid triggering the vacated modified standard by simply keeping your emissions below that level, right?
Well, it's not vacated yet, but the standard that's under reconsideration.
That's the argument, right?
Yes, and also that PCA offered no basis to stay the standard. A stay was not appropriate under the APA because the effective date of the rule had already passed, and PCA...
Isn't the agency's response to petitioner essentially the same as saying you have to comply with the standard while we reconsider it?
Well, again, EPA hasn't determined that the standard is wrong or that it's unlawful. It's simply deciding to rethink the standard. So in this case, our answer to that is that, yes, we're talking about modifications here. This is something that PCA has the power to avoid triggering the modification provision in the first place. It can decide not to make any operational or physical changes to the stationary sources at the plants.
Yeah, I was only asking the question because I was responding to the agency's point that, look, there's no harm here, right? But from the kiln's point of view, that might be a harm, right?
We would say that
they're limited in their modifications they adopt while the agency's reconsidering it, even though the agency might change the standard. So it doesn't seem to me you've answered their concern by simply saying, well, all you have to do is not increase your emissions. I guess it seems to me circular. What am I missing?
Well, what we also say here is that PCA offered nothing in support of its petition for a stay to show that it would be difficult to avoid triggering the modification provision. Mm-hmm. It simply can't avoid making changes that would trigger the modification provision while EPA is deciding to, is taking this standard under reconsideration. Uh-huh. And under these circumstances, EPA's denial of the stay was entirely reasonable. Now, in addition to the PM standard for modified sources, PCA also challenges the SO2 and NOx standards for modified kilns. standards which are both unique to the NSPS. And in its opening brief, PCA argued quite extensively that these standards were unreasonable and arbitrary and capricious because EPA failed to analyze kilns of older design. In response, EPA showed the numerous places in the record where it did in fact analyze kilns of older design, and EPA determined that these sources can comply with the NSPS limits. Now, in its reply...
Is this the preheater, pre-calciner issue you're talking about now?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, Your Honor.
Go ahead.
Now, with respect to the SO2 standard, PCA, despite PCA's contention, EPA did include kilns of older design. Second, in the record, EPA concluded that there is no issue with the ability of these older kilns to comply with the SO2 standard because the same controls, lime injection and wet scrubbers, can be applied to kilns of any type and achieve the same standard as a newer kiln. Third, EPA standard was proven to be achievable regardless of how high a kiln's uncontrolled rate of sulfur is, and that's something that that PCA makes a point of in its briefing, that EPA didn't take this into account when in fact it did. Kilns with high sulfur in their raw materials can simply use wet scrubbers to achieve a 90% SO2 reduction. Wet scrubbers have consistently achieved 90 to 95% reduction rates. This is not a post hoc rationalization. PCA's arguments on the NOx limit is also entirely misses the point. Again, EPA did not dispute the fact that kilns of older design can have much higher levels of uncontrolled NOx emissions. In fact, EPA made this point explicitly in the record. But what EPA determined, consistent with the ASARCO decision that this court made, was that EPA reasoned that plant owners may adopt measures so that their hourly emissions do not increase, therefore avoid triggering a modification provision in the first place. This is exactly what EPA reasoned, that these kilns have these higher rates of uncontrolled NOx emissions, but that numerous controls were available so that these kilns would not increase their hourly emissions of NOx. Furthermore, EPA did include or did analyze kilns of older design, and some have demonstrated the ability to meet the NOx limit. So modifying kilns of older design may be able to meet the final limit. I just want to talk briefly about EPA's decision not to include a greenhouse gas standard. EPA was reasonable in declining not to adopt a greenhouse gas standard at this time.
Now, wait a minute. I thought the agency's argument was that it's going to. It just needs more information.
The agency has said that this is not the end of the matter and that it will send out requests for information to fill the gaps. It has said that.
Well,
based on lack of information.
Didn't you just say that it wasn't unreasonable for the agency to decide not to regulate?
Well, that's what happened here. And the agency, we in this case did not dispute that this is reviewable action under
I mean, you're not arguing this is not final agency action.
We determined that it was akin to a deferral. That's what we determined. And that is, therefore, it's reasonable that this court has jurisdiction to review the decision and determine whether or not EPA acted reasonably in doing so. But its decision was because it made its decision not to regulate greenhouse gases because it lacked information. So in this instance, it was reasonable for EPA to do so. It explained in the record the types of information that it lacked. It determined that without that information, it could not even begin to attempt to make a determination.
Does the agency argue that environmental petitioners lack standing? Do you think they have standing?
We did not.
Well, what do you think? if you don't have a view out, just tell me.
We don't have a view on whether or not they have standing in this case. We didn't brief that issue. So EPA satisfactorily explained why it was declining to regulate greenhouse gas emissions at this time. Now, environmental petitioners assert that EPA doesn't need the site-specific information that it said it needed, but the NSPS National Line case plainly requires that EPA consider specific variable factors and conditions that are relevant to the emissions controls considered, in this case, site-specific data. The information in the record doesn't meet this criteria. As set forth in our brief, The data and studies in the record are highly generalized information that broadly discusses potential control.
Let me just interrupt you on the matter. I'm just curious about your argument about it being final agency action. So EPA's position, am I right? EPA's position really is that if its view is, look, we're going to regulate this particular pollutant, we just don't yet have enough information, right? We're going to collect the information. This isn't the end of the matter. That's the language the agency used. That's a final agency action that the agency concedes is reviewable?
Your Honor, I don't want to overstate the situation. I'll just say in this instance, EPA determined that it, or did not dispute that the action is reviewable under...
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying. I'm not quite sure I understand. Well, see whether the government understands the consequences of the argument.
Well, again, that's why I don't want to overstate anything. Yeah, in this instance, it did make a final rule, and the final rule did not include a standard for greenhouse gases. So in that sense...
Am I wrong that the final rule said we haven't included it here because, A, we don't have enough information, and, B, when we get it, we're going to set a standard? Am I reading the agency correctly?
That's in essence what the agency said,
and
yes.
The agency's position is that's final agency action, huh? Okay.
Now, in the past, this court has upheld EPA's determinations that because of specific information gaps...
I suspect we may hear a different view in other cases sometime in the future. I mean, that...
Well, that's why I want to make sure I'm...
I don't understand how you're limiting it.
In this instance... There was final agency action, which was the rule that was promulgated. That action did not include a standard for greenhouse gases. EPA didn't include the standard because it didn't have the information to do so at the time. Now, so in this instance, the agency did not dispute or does not dispute that the action was reviewable under the Clean Air Act.
Okay.
But I want to be clear here that to the extent environmental petitioners are arguing that EPA unreasonably delayed acting, or that to the extent environmental petitioners argue that EPA had a mandatory duty to regulate greenhouse gases, those issues are not properly before the court. Those issues should be in the district court. The only issue here is whether EPA acted reasonably in deciding not to include a greenhouse gas standard in the final rule, and as it's explained, EPA's action was reasonable. Now, if the court somehow disagrees and is inclined to remand the matter back to the agency, we submit that the court should not establish a deadline. The court may set deadlines in exceptional cases, but beyond mere allegations of delay, environmental petitioners have not set forth any substantial justification for the exceptional relief that they seek. Undoubtedly, greenhouse gas regulation is a very unique and complex issue, and only EPA can determine how long it will take to complete such a rulemaking with respect to the Portland cement industry. So, again, if the court is inclined to remand, we respectfully submit that the court not impose a schedule. Unless the court has any further questions, we thank you, and we respectfully request the court deny the petitions. Thank you.
How much time does Mr. Doniger have left?
He doesn't have
any time. All right. Mr. Doniger, why don't you take... Well...
I'm intervening on behalf.
I know, but don't you want to respond... To the extent.
Oh. Okay.
All right. Now let me ask you this, Mr. Phillips. Do you have anything? You have time left, I believe, as the petitioner.
Right.
So can you just incorporate?
Can I do both?
You've got five. Why? How much time does he have left from that?
About 3.5 minutes.
All right. Why don't you take?
Take my eight and be done.
We'll just see how long you go. But address anything. In response to Ms. Peoples and also the standing issue.
Okay, let me start with the greenhouse gas standard since that was just addressed, and then I'll try to shift gears and deal with the other issues or with the NSPS problems generally. With respect to the greenhouse gas, it seems to me pretty clear, Judge Tatel, that your interpretation of 307B2 is absolutely right. This is not a final order within the meaning of that provision, because it talks in terms of any non-discretionary statutory action. And it's pretty clear here that there is no non-discretionary statutory action on the table, because there's nothing in the requirement of review that says that EPA even has to consider greenhouse gases. All it talks about is review and revising of the existing rules. So the 8-year requirement doesn't impose any non-discretionary duty. Second, EPA acknowledged. I mean, the truth is, if they had adopted, if they had done exactly what the environmental petitioners are complaining about, we would be here today making exactly the same argument we made in the clinker storage argument, which is there's no notice of proposed rulemaking, and you can't adopt a final rule, in which case we'd be back to square one anyway. And it seems to me, in that context in particular, it's sort of absurd to be sitting here thinking about how what to do under those circumstances. EPA recognized it had no ability to adopt a final rule. And more fundamentally, procedurally and substantively, it recognized it didn't have the information necessary to allow it even to begin to propose the final rule. And the notion that there's some fixed set of a couple of criteria that apply in this context, as opposed to the wide range of information that EPA has to consider as part of the rulemaking process dictated beyond what the APA requires, but what the Clean Air Act requires in this particular context, strikes me as simply unsustainable under these circumstances. So, you know, what EPA did here was perfectly reasonable under the circumstances, and the right course to follow is to allow that part of this case to play itself out, and eventually EPA will, I assume, do something with respect to greenhouse gases. And if they don't act quickly enough, then, as you say, Judge Tatel, that's the business of mandamus, and the environmental petitioners can certainly take action under those circumstances, or alternatively, they can try to move that process along by proposing their own rulemaking. And they also obviously retain their citizen suit authority to try to force EPA to deal with various timelines. There are a lot of options available. It seems to me the least available, or the least likely, or the most least sensible under these circumstances is to completely distort 307b2, allowing much more review by this court of non-actions by the EPA. And on that score, I'm 100% sure you're right, Judge Tatel, that you would hear a different argument from EPA at various times going forward. My guess is you've probably heard a different argument in the past. But the bottom line here is it cannot possibly be that there is a rule just for this case that deals with 307b2. I will then switch gears quickly in terms of the NESHAP and NSPS problem here. I mean, yeah, the NESHAP NSPS conundrum. I guess that's my third or fourth conundrum under these circumstances. Here, as I listen to EPA's counsel, she provides precisely the post hoc rationalization that is the flaw in the way EPA approached this. I mean, she cites quite rightly to 1148 in the joint appendix as the basis for the EPA's analysis. But what EPA said there is because all new sources will be required to meet this limit, we see no reason to set a different limit for the NSPS. There is none of that. We analyzed every one of these facilities. We examined them for questions of cost. We examined them for a few. All that was in the original notice of proposed rulemaking, all of which the agency simply threw out the window, saying, wait a second, we have a shortcut. We can do this without having to put any effort into this. We'll just adopt the NESHAP. Well, the problem with that is that's, one, illegal. Two, doesn't take care of the modification problem. With respect to the stay, I mean, her answer there is pretty remarkable. You know, the industry should do nothing while all of this is pending, for however long it's pending, out of fear that it's going to end up violating a standard that is otherwise perfectly illegal under these circumstances. So it seems to me the court ought to reject that. And then with respect to NOx and sulfur dioxide, on that score, the notion that these older kilns were evaluated under these circumstances is simply defied by the EPA's own record in this case. And EPA's brief is quite remarkable in the way it modifies what EPA analyzed with respect to those old kilns. It was evaluating them strictly on the basis of a substantial modification, because it talks about two where there was a complete change in the facilities. There is not a shred of evidence with respect to the kind of operational modification that's going to create hourly rates. Those are very easy standards to violate, and with the strict standards that have been imposed by EPA across the board, it is no longer achievable to be able to manipulate how you operate your system in order to ensure compliance. The court ought to vacate these rules and ask the EPA to do it right. If there are no further questions, I think I've taken up all my time. Thank you, Your Honor.
Now, Mr. Doniger, why don't you take 2 minutes?
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just Tatel asked for cases. Maine versus Thomas is a 1989 case, 874 F. 2nd, 883. There, the court, First Circuit was reviewing a 304 action, which was brought because EPA had issued some regulations on regional haze and had promised to take further action in the future. What the First Circuit concluded there was, quote, a promise to act in futuro, unquote, was a final agency action that had to be reviewed in this court. And
that was the First Circuit.
That was the First Circuit. It was in 1989. B2, the provision on deferral, was adopted in 1990, and it was adopted in part to try to clarify this jurisdictional ping-pong over these kinds of cases.
Let me ask you this. Could EPA, in its proposed, in its notice, it didn't propose any greenhouse gas regulations at all, right?
That's correct. And we don't contend that it could have left.
So then how could it have issued a final regulation?
We don't contend
at all.
We don't contend that you can leap to a final without a proposal. But there's a duty to get to a final within a time period, and that includes.
So now you're talking mandamus again.
We're here because the agency didn't carry out, issued a final action in which they did not carry out part of their responsibilities, and that's the case that's addressed by B2, if not by B1. Yeah. If I may, a couple of other points.
Do you want to say anything about standing?
Well, no one else did, but I can add that.
It's up to you. I just asked you a question.
Yes, I would say about standing that our coastal landowners, members, are in the same position as the, with the same harms, in the same chain of causation, and the same redressability argument that was sustained in Massachusetts. Now, the court actually applied, whatever was said about states, the court actually applied the Lujan test and held that the harms, et cetera, had been demonstrated against the most demanding adversarial standards. We have evidence in the record and in the declarations, scientific declarations, member declarations, which are at least the equal of the evidence that was before this court and the Supreme Court in Massachusetts. There's no basis for holding citizens to a higher standard than the Lujan test, and we meet the Lujan test. I would only add that the government's presentation does not contest that there was a final action, doesn't seem to contest that.
Of course, that's a jurisdictional question for us to decide.
Yes.
Right?
I would add one other point, that the government's elaboration in its brief of the reasons why they now contend that the data in the record wasn't sufficient are actually not laid out in the Federal Register notice. They are post hoc elaborations of what's supposedly wrong with the evidence in the record. If there are no further questions, thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.